Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Moopa Podcast. Today's guest is a distinguished associate professor and principal research fellow at the University of Melbourne. His primary areas of research focuses on body image, eating disorders, body dysmorphia, and the stigmatization surrounding mental health. His research has received over 14 international and national awards, including awards from the Australian Academy of Science, the Society of Mental Health, and the University of Sydney. Just to list some of his awards and achievements, he's designed and delivered interventions and workforces for a range of audiences, including health professionals and policymakers. And he also leads a research group called the Physical Appearance Research Team, which work on appearance-focused psychological disorders. He's also been awarded the Early Career Scholar Award at the Society of Mental Health Research in 2016.
Hello, everyone. Today we're joined with Associate Professor Scott Griffiths. Did I pronounce your last name right?
You did.
Awesome. How about you tell us a bit about yourself and your research, Scott?
Sure. I'm an associate professor here in the School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Melbourne. I lead a research team called the Physical Appearance Research Team. We do work with all manner of psychological conditions where physical appearance is an element. Could be eating disorders like anorexia, which I imagine many of your listeners are familiar with, but through to less commonly understood disorders like body dysmorphic disorder, including folks who seek appearance enhancement or modification for various reasons. Could be drugs like anabolic steroids. It could be gender reassignment surgeries in order to look more like one's chosen gender. Yeah, that's the broad ambit of what we do.
Kind of just building on what you mentioned before, Scott, if you could explain maybe like the differences between body dysmorphia and eating disorders, and then how do they kind of relate to maybe like the male experience, would you say?
Sure. So eating disorders, the distinguishing criterion, if you'd like, from body dysmorphic disorder is that you're wrapped up in food in some way, shape or form. So if you have anorexia, for example, then often you are restricting what you eat to a really extreme degree, can often become malnourished and end up in a hospital. If you have bulimia nervosa, then you get trapped in these recurrent cycles of binging a whole lot of food, which means eating large quantities you don't feel able to stop, and then you subsequently purge the food that you've just eaten. That could be through inducing vomiting or taking laxatives or something similar to that. So by and large, eating disorders, there's something going on with food there, even if the fundamental motivators could be something other than food. So you might be wrapped up in food, not because food is something you're preoccupied with primarily, but because you want to look a certain way. Body dysmorphic disorder, the focus isn't on food per se. It's kind of preoccupation about some part of your appearance. And that's the be-all and end-all. That's the primary thing. So, for example, someone with body dysmorphic disorder might walk in and say to me, "Scott, my nose is misshapen and deformed and everyone notices it and everyone's laughing behind my back about it and I really want to change it." And the fundamental criterion is that the defect that person perceives that they have is either non-existent or very slight. And it's that discordance between the subjective interpretation of the sufferer and objective reality that's the hallmark of body dysmorphic disorder.
Would you say kind of body dysmorphia and eating disorders are very like comorbid, like you see them come together when a person presents with those conditions?
Yeah, they're not particularly comorbid, more comorbid than you might otherwise expect. Generally speaking, if the preoccupation and the discordance between subjective reality and objective reality is to do with musculature or body fat or body shape, we err on the side of trying to diagnose that as an eating disorder because food will always be centrally involved in the psychopathology, if that makes sense.
Yeah. How would you distinguish between, I guess, normal preoccupation with the body, you know, trying to look better, you know, you're a young 20-year-old guy, you want to improve your looks, go to the gym maybe. Maybe you're even a bit harsh about how you look to begin with, which is what motivated you to start lifting or doing any form of exercise to start with. How would you distinguish between that and something that a psychologist or a psychiatrist might diagnose as an eating disorder if it has to do with food, or a body dysmorphic disorder if it has to do with like negative body image?
Great question. So preoccupation in a clinical context has pretty specific meaning. When I'm saying preoccupation, I'm talking on average perhaps 4 to 5 hours a day thinking about eating, training, and the way you look, you know, each and every day, week in, week out. That's where we would say someone is preoccupied. Even that is not enough for you to have a diagnosis. In psychology, clinical psychology, we're not in the business of taking people's, you know, obsessions, hobbies, things that they're just really keen about, and turning them into disorders if they're not. There has to be this thing we call clinical or functional impairment, which is to say it has to be ruining your day in some way, shape, or form. So if you're in the gym, I don't know, doing a bodybuilding split 6 days a week, and you really take quite seriously what you eat, and you do care quite a lot about the way you look, you don't have muscle dysmorphia. You could have muscle dysmorphia if when you wake up in the morning, you look in the mirror, the first thoughts that enter your head are, you look like shit, you look like garbage, you look like you barely train, etc. If you have a day where you don't hit your macros, let's say, you turn it inward and start to punish yourself and be critical. If you have an injury, you feel so anxious about losing your progress that you end up getting back in the gym too early and either re-injuring yourself or just going into a doom loop of feeling even poorer because you're not making the progress that you want. It's all about your psychological interpretations of what's going on.
Yeah.
That's the distinguishing factor.
Is it hard to reasonably tell if a person is just very committed to the gym and being healthy or perhaps looking good versus there is maybe a darker or more unhealthy motivation there as well? Or do they usually go hand in hand? It's hard to separate them.
No, they don't necessarily go hand in hand. It's easy for me if I sit down in front of someone for an hour and run you through a proper interview. But in terms of being able to know just from people that you might see in the gym, I'd say extremely unlikely, because you can have folks who, this is just something that is a really big hobby for them, they're really dedicated to it, and body image or something to do with the way they look or wanting to be more attractive could have been a motivating factor either in the past or it could still be even then. That in and of itself doesn't amount to much. Most of the population is concerned to at least a small degree with the way they look and ideally wanting to be more attractive, et cetera, et cetera. It really comes down to the kinds of questions where answers reveal that someone's self-esteem and self-worth is predicated on looking a certain way, keeping up progress in the gym, and having their diet on lock. And when any of that gets threatened, unlike someone with a healthy relationship with their appearance and their food and their training, who kind of just takes it as it comes and then maybe gets back on, if someone is suffering from a disorder like muscle dysmorphia, it can send them into a panic. They can really be super unkind to themselves. And that's the clinical impairment. Like it's not bringing them joy from day to day. It's sending them on massive ups and downs.
I see.
Would you say kind of with like how you hinted before, like it's very like prevalent with people who have like a very fixed focus on external experience. Is there with the people that you work with, is there like certain occupations and backgrounds? Is it like mostly like bodybuilders, maybe models in a sense? Is there like a very like prevalent occupation?
You do get more folks than you would expect statistically who are, say, personal trainers or otherwise in jobs where your physical appearance is either, you know, part of your job performance, say if you are a fitness model or a model in general, or where the size of your body isn't part of your performance per se, but it's conspicuous and might help you. So if you are, for example, a police officer, then the size of your body can be a passive deterrent to criminal offenders, and that can just make you more body conscious. You spend more time thinking in that space, could be a little more likely to develop muscle dysmorphia. Won't say that you necessarily will, but yeah. Important to note, though, that the majority of folks who have the disorder are white-collar professionals. They're just regular people, many of them with university degrees, and yeah, they've just found themselves in a headspace where all the training and the dieting is doing them more harm than good most days.
That's so interesting. I think I read something that in Britain, only like somewhat related to what you said, the number one reason people use anabolic steroids in the context of like performance enhancement is not for like competitive bodybuilding or like actually getting performance boosts in performance-based sports. It's to look better. So they don't even have to do it for their profession or to get like an edge over someone. They just do it because, yeah, they want to look better.
Yeah. When we started this research, you know, about 10 years ago now, if you were to talk to young men in the gym doing clear bodybuilding splits and you say, why are you doing this? There would be this kind of subterfuge where it's, oh, I'm doing it for health or a sport, etc. Now it's a lot more common for guys to be straight up and say, I'm doing this because I want to look better, or it's an aesthetics thing. And that study you're referring to captures that very well, where even though a lot of men, especially in decades past, might have been loath to admit to others that the reason they're doing this is because they want to look better, the statistics don't lie. Like steroid users in Australia, it's between 90 and 95% are doing it purely to look better. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about steroids and doping in sport, it's like barely any. There's barely any. For every one person who's using it to get a competitive edge in, you know, some sort of sport, you've got 19 who are using it just to look better.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So you said that a few decades ago, or maybe 10 years ago, men in the gym would have said, yeah, I'm lifting for health. I want to be healthy. Maybe avoid, I don't know, being too skinny, too overweight, but I'm not trying to, you know, looks max up my aesthetics, so to speak. Why do you think young males now, are more readily able to admit that they're doing it for looks?
Well, it turns like look maxing and folks discussing this on social media is a sign of the times. 15 years ago, 20, 30, you didn't get that. Mm-hmm. Men having mental health concerns, anxieties, insecurities at all was not something seen as particularly masculine or desirable. It doesn't exactly exude the confidence that a lot of young men are told to build. So especially if it's in an appearance domain, the concern was that it looked kind of feminine or weak or some combination of that. Now, maybe social media has assisted this and we've had, you know, gender roles, especially for men, contemporized. You get much more frank and honest admissions of the motivations for working in the gym to build a body that looks different from the one that you have, where you can just say, look, physical attractiveness is important to a degree, and it's something that I would like to have more of or more confidence in that area, so I'm going to go to the gym explicitly for this reason.
Would you say, like, kind of contrasting the experiences, is there a lot of distinctions between the male and female experience when it comes to body dysmorphia?
Yeah. So one of the issues in the DSM, our kind of clinical psychology bible, is right now, if you have anorexia, it's called an eating disorder. If you have muscle dysmorphia, we classify it as body dysmorphic disorder. It probably should be classified as an eating disorder. For the purposes of our chat, I'm going to treat them both as eating disorders, because where things fall diagnostically in our manuals, our treatment manuals, is always something of ongoing research. So anorexia versus muscle dysmorphia, the gender ratios in terms of those who suffer from it are what you might expect. Majority of those who suffer from anorexia are female, and majority of those who suffer from muscle dysmorphia are male. And it reflects differences in the kinds of bodies that men and women on average try to build for themselves. So if I take 50 young boys in high school and say, describe the body you want to have for yourself, they'll use terms like jacked, lean, built, snatched, etc. Women won't use those terms. The kind of body that they're trying to build is very different. And because it's so different what they're trying to build, the training is completely different, the dieting is completely different, the kinds of psychology that you're up against when you're trying to do those diets, do those trainings, that's different, through to the drugs that you may use in order to achieve those physiques. So if you're trying to get thin and skinny, you're not going to go and use anabolic steroids. But, you know, a young dude who's trying to get jacked, he will. So you end up with essentially an eating disorder motivated by the same type of concerns and worries and insecurities, that the manifestation, the way that it actually appears out in the world, completely different for men versus women.
And if you only consider, if your scope of what, like an eating disorder or an unhealthy preoccupation with the body is just like about fitness, and you don't also look at the other side of the other side of it, like a preoccupation with looking as jacked and ripped as humanly possible, then you might exclude a lot of men that are also suffering from that, from that discussion.
Yeah, and that's been a thrust of the research over the past decade. Things like trying to improve measurement so that if you are doing screening for folks who may be at risk of having an eating disorder, you're not inadvertently screening out a young man who is not preoccupied with the amount of fat in food, he's more preoccupied with protein. There are questions that used to be on eating disorder questionnaires like, oh, are you trying to get a flat stomach? And men will respond, you know, they'll kind of engage with that question. But if you adjust it just slightly to you're trying to get, you know, a six pack or something similar, then suddenly their scores change quite a lot. And we've been able to show that with just some modest changes to existing questionnaires, you can capture a lot more of the men at risk because what they're trying to do looks different. Part of the broader underlying message is similar to what you mentioned in your question, which is that eating disorders can really manifest as anything depending on the type of body people are trying to achieve for themselves. And when you look broadly across genders, different cultures, types of bodies people think are ideal and try to build differ quite a lot. Mm-hmm. So we're moving into this space where the type of training, dieting, psychology that you can find in eating disorders is much more diverse than one might otherwise expect if they're coming at it from a frame of really eating disorders are synonymous with anorexia, for example.
Among men and boys, who would you say are most at risk and why?
If you have a certain psychology, then you're more at risk. If you are unlucky enough to have a low opinion of yourself, which you might call low self-esteem or low self-worth, then that's going to be a struggle. If that is combined with, say, a streak of perfectionism, so when you do something, you want to do it really well and you're quite critical of yourself, if you don't meet that very high standard, that's going to make it harder again. If you have a tendency to get a bit obsessive about things, then that will make it harder again. Obsessive could be, for example, you need to have the perfect training regimen, the perfect diet, find yourself on forums or whatever kind of information source you have, endlessly trawling, trying to optimize. That can make it harder still. If you're coupling that with some beliefs that are not particularly helpful or nuanced, for example, if you have come to believe, for whatever reason, that if you don't look physically attractive, you will never find someone to love you, which is something that comes up when you talk to folks who are suffering from the disorder, that's going to make it harder still. Maybe you've had some kind of experience in childhood that's fed into those beliefs. You could, as one of our guys with muscle dysmorphia we worked with earlier this year had, he grew up as a skinny kid. He was, you know, on the later side to start puberty and used to have other boys who'd gone through puberty early and were bigger come up to him in the schoolyard and, you know, try to put their fingers around his wrists, and that made him feel quite you know, emasculated, that can feed into it too. So it's not any one thing. It's a combination of orange flags that can make it more likely that you're a red flag for muscle dysmorphia.
I feel like for me, it's kind of like sometimes you have like, when you're bombarded with a lot of like imagery on social media about like how you, like you should look like this, you should look like that, you kind of get like, you kind of put this umbrella pressure of like, oh, I need to like achieve this, I need to achieve that.
Social media is really unkind to people who are insecure about the way that they look. And we do a lot of research in the team on the algorithms that recommend content to you on TikTok and elsewhere. And because they're trying to engage you, where engage means can keep you on the platform for as long as possible, if the algorithm picks up that you spend more time looking at videos that feature people who look better than you, right, and you spend more time watching that, you'll just keep getting sent that. And over time, your frame of reference for what a regular body looks like, that gets further and further from what regular actually is, until you can find yourself in an echo chamber where, you know, folks who walk into our offices because they've got muscle dysmorphia that think they might can be objectively very muscular, right? But if you look at their TikTok For You page or their Instagram feed, everyone on there looks bigger than them.
Yeah.
So it's a 95th percentile comparing to a 99th percentile. And social media will always set you up for that.
Wow. Yeah. It's also the selection bias. Like, imagine, I don't know, 100 pretty muscular men are, like, uploading stuff to Instagram or YouTube or something. But, like, eventually those who, like, the 10 that will be featured on the homepage or the For You page of YouTube or Instagram or TikTok will eventually be the most, like, aesthetic, jacked, ripped guys with the best genetics, or perhaps those who take steroids or whatnot. So even if you are, like you said, objectively very muscular, you'll feel like, damn, like all these people on Instagram just look way better than me. But that's kind of like how the algorithm's not designed to select for them, because that's what people will eventually be drawn to, if that makes sense.
Correct. Anabolic steroids are a particularly potent issue here. I describe it as a bit of a public health campaign issue for muscle dysmorphia, because at least when you're talking about anorexia or thinness-oriented eating disorders where laxatives and diuretics are commonly abused, I have the advantage of saying, look, the evidence shows that when you take laxatives or diuretics to try and expunge the calories from your body that you were otherwise going to absorb, it doesn't work. You still absorb the vast majority of it. So why take them if it doesn't work? Steroids work exceptionally well, right? One of the more challenging articles I had to get published was simply one saying that if we don't be honest about how well anabolic steroids work, we can never effectively treat the psychology of someone who is comparing themselves against people who use them or someone who's been using them and wants to come off, because the advantages that they give you in terms of your ability to build muscle on suboptimal diets and training, etc., are considerable. There's a reason why the International Olympic Committee, other sporting federations, work so hard to keep anabolic steroids out of sport. Now, on social media, where there are financial incentives and just clout incentives to build huge followings, anabolic steroids are the norm, not the exception. And that comes from having spoken with so many people inside of that world, some in quite high places with big followings. They are everywhere. And what ends up happening is you have someone who, say, 14-year-old boy who has what I think is not a fundamentally disordered insecurity to have at some point where he might think, oh, you know, those other boys are bigger than me. Maybe I should be bigger, etc. Maybe he dabbles in the gym for a while, does some training. And it would never matter how optimized his training and dieting were, because if he's comparing himself to someone on anabolic steroids, he's going to lose that fight. mm-hmm. almost every single time.
Yeah.
And it's a bit of a bait and switch when I hear people who use anabolic steroids or who are just broadly in that world saying, oh, it doesn't really matter. You still have to be able to diet and train to make the best of it. When you look at the data, that's not a convincing mm-hmm. argument. Now, having said all that, this is not an advertisement for anabolic steroids. If they didn't have the side effects that they do, the health, long-term health implications, then I'd be agnostic about it and say, yeah, go and experiment with them and have fun. But they absolutely ruin the endocrine functioning of people who use them. And it's a tragedy when someone young has compared themselves to a steroid user, has come to use steroids themselves, and then they get to 28, 29, want to have a kid, and they're infertile. They're going to be on TRT for the rest of their lives, or they've got an enlarged heart. All sorts of things happen.
Yeah, a lot of nasty side effects.
Yeah, yeah, and unfortunately not overblown. I wish I could say that they were, but the side effects are very considerable.
Yeah.
Is there also like a very strong like psychological consequences for using steroids? Like I've heard people like there's like very like strong emotional dysregulation. Like you get, you're a bit more on edge, you're a bit more sensitive, you're a bit more angry and everything like that.
Yeah. So the earlier thinking about it was that, oh, if you have more testosterone in your system, and a basic anabolic steroid is just synthetic testosterone, then that might be what drives the increased irritability, sometimes paranoia, aggression that you see in folks who use steroids. But the more modern thinking is that it might be to do with volatility in testosterone and the other hormones that come with administering synthetic testosterone. Like testosterone can aromatize into estrogen, for example. And when you flood the body with an amount of testosterone that can be anywhere from 5 to 15 times what a male would make naturally, so a super physiological dose of testosterone, you introduce a lot of volatility, a lot of ups and downs into the system, which now will stop making testosterone and therefore everything else that comes from testosterone naturally. That's why males' testicles shrink, because the majority of that is due to making testosterone. If you flood it, it'll stop. So you've got all of this volatility in many of these emotions, these hormones that are linked through to emotional functioning. And that's where the kinds of psychology you were describing comes from. And if you have been on steroids for a while and now you're trying to come off, you go through that big time. So we end up with guys who are psychologically dependent on steroids. It's around 1/3 of steroid users that we see who end up psychologically dependent. They're really struggling to come off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot of guys also don't, I suppose, at least here in Australia, don't get steroids or other anabolic compounds from like the chemist. They'll just go to some guy at the gym, like the big guy at the gym who's selling steroids, and you don't really know like where the guy is producing them and making them. Like they might have something else there. It might just not be high quality. It's seems like quite a big risk as well.
Yeah. I mean, a not uncommon situation is, you know, there might be testosterone powders. They're bought China or elsewhere in Asia, imported, and then made in, you know, whatever kind of sink or bathtub you can find with oils to suspend them in. And then those are put into the vials, and then good luck. And you have to hope that at every stage that's been done in as sanitized a manner as possible, that there hasn't been cut or diluted in some way, that it is the actual steroid that you think you're buying. So some steroids like trenbolone, harder to find, more expensive, you may not be getting what you buy. And because these are being injected intramuscularly, so quite long needles that you need to use to inject these into the muscles in the body where they need to go, if there's any kinds of contaminants at all, you're going to end up with an abscess, and it's not going to go away on its own in all likelihood. It's a drama.
I feel like for me, let's say like with people who know the risk of taking, let's say, steroids or anything like that, I feel like maybe if I could use the same framework, let's say a person who smokes, right? And they know the risk of smoking, but they still do it. Would you say, like, there's, I know we've touched on social media, but would you say there are a lot of other kind of factors that kind of drive that like motivation, like, no, I'm just going to do it anyway, even though I know the consequences that happen?
Well, yeah, if you've come to believe that looking a certain way, being more attractive is what you need, right? It's the thing that's going to fix your life, set you right, get you the respect from other men that you perhaps didn't have before so that you can get the girls that you didn't think you could get, or the men, then, yeah, you've got the temptations behind you to do it. You might do what is not uncommon for a lot of young people, which is to discount future consequences. So, you know, it's telling someone who's 18, 19 on social media a lot, who wants to get big, that they might regret this decision, say, in 5 years' time if they meet someone want to have kids, or in 20 years' time when their cardiovascular system starts to give way. Those consequences don't necessarily feel as immediate or salient at that point.
They don't care. They just want, no, bro, I just want to get the girls. Like, what do you mean?
Sure.
Like 18 years old.
Yeah. And we live in a society, I think, encouraged by technology like social media, but even before it with movies and TV, that encourages people to see how they look as the principal determinant of their self-worth and attractiveness. The number of young boys and girls whose main insecurity, or their number two or number three, has to do with how they look, and who can hold on to that insecurity for years, even into young adulthood, is staggering. They call it normative body dissatisfaction, not because it's normal, but because it's more likely, if you just pick a young boy or young girl from an Australian school, that they will tell you they're insecure about their appearance than to find someone who will say that they're comfortable. So it's the norm. And technologies like social media just make that worse. And it means that decisions that have potentially life-altering consequences, like anabolic steroids or plastic surgery, look more acceptable and are taken up by more people at younger ages than in generations past.
Would you say there's, like, throughout your research that you found there's, like, barriers or obstacles that people facing these conditions, people with these conditions face, let's say, like, the stigma around seeking help with having these conditions? Is there something that, like, that you found throughout your research?
I would say the main barrier is folks' denial about having a problem. That is a stage folks can be in for years. Not uncommon for people who are really in the throes of an eating disorder or muscle dysmorphia to arrive in one of our studies or show up interested in treatment because they've had something go really wrong. Maybe they lost a relationship they really valued because the other person just couldn't stay in it anymore alongside the disorder, or they've lost a job, or a health consequence has really scared them. And that has what has allowed them to overcome that denial and finally start to seek help. So I'd say that's the number one. The second would be the cost. It's extremely expensive to get treatment in the private sector, and that's where most treatment providers are. And then the third one, I suppose, would be stigma, though I really feel that men's willingness to discuss these kinds of issues has improved a lot. Even on TikTok, on forums, men will joke about their body dysmorphia or muscle dysmorphia. It's kind of a trolley kind of willingness to discuss that stuff. So I like to think that stigma will become a less potent reason in years to come.
Why do you think that has been occurring?
In the last 10 years in particular, the amount of discourse on mental health has exploded. Mental health gets discussed widely on TikTok, and I think that helps a lot of men just to be able to talk about this kind of thing. I don't think it would be the norm, for example, for someone in Melbourne to hear a man saying, yeah, I feel insecure about the way I look, and interpret that as some foundationally negative thing about that person that impacts upon, you know, their masculinity or fundamental self-worth, they're just probably like, oh, that sucks. And then it goes from there.
So the awareness has changed a lot over the last decades.
Yeah, it has.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely like touching on, I know it's kind of like a double-edged sword with social media. Like you can use it as a platform where you can like spread positive awareness of like, of let's say, as we mentioned before, but it's also in a sense where like it can just exacerbate the whole situation. Yeah.
Yeah, with the stuff we're doing with TikTok algorithms at the moment makes that pretty clear. And if you have an insecurity about the way that you look and you're on TikTok, then it's extremely likely that your algorithm will start to reflect that insecurity pretty quickly.
So I guess I'm just piggybacking over something you said. So you were saying that one obstacle that men and maybe even people in general face is like maybe denial that it is a problem. Could you maybe elaborate on that, specifically, you know, eating disorders and, yeah.
Well, like, let's background it to just human psychology in general. Humans are great at being in denial about lots of things. So it's not unique to muscle dysmorphia or eating disorders. We can be in denial that we're in a bad relationship. We can be in denial about all sorts of behaviors that we get up to. And so we can be in denial about just how far down the rabbit hole of training and dieting we've gone. So not uncommon for folks who eventually seek treatment or end up in one of our research studies to be telling us that, yeah, if I don't relax my eating and my rules around the food that I eat and when I eat, then my partner said that she's going to leave me. And it's decision points, pain points like that that help to break someone out of the denial.
Let's say, zooming out, let's say with a person who, maybe this is maybe going a bit out of topic, but let's say a person who just regularly goes to the gym, and this is more, maybe more like a philosophy standpoint, but let's say you have insecurities about like your looks or your aesthetics. Is there maybe like steps or any strategies a person that can take to kind of like, not alleviate, but kind of just reduce that like catastrophic thinking?
Well, yeah, the most foundational thing that you could do for yourself would be to build self-worth that's predicated on a diverse set of things, right? It's okay to have your appearance be part of your self-worth because our appearance goes beyond just what we build in a gym. It can be the way that you style your hair. It can be the particular style of glasses that you have. Like you've both arrived here today, not just having thrown on clothes at random. It's part of, you know, your aesthetic. And it's okay to have some of your self-worth be based on that. I'd say that's totally normal, but it can't be the only thing. It couldn't be. You can't have your self-worth based on just one thing at all, because then if it gets threatened for any reason, your whole world is at risk of falling apart and you run the risk of burrowing deeper and deeper onto this one thing because it just feels so important. If it was your job that gave you all your self-worth, we'd just say that that person also had an issue. So that's the foundational thing there. And moving beyond that, if you can have a self-worth predicated not just on appearance, but appearance and other things, then it would be watching out for that mean internal voice coming over the top and being unkind to yourself about your training or dieting or the way that you look. So let's say you missed out on the gym for a week. Things are really busy with uni. You were just feeling a little bit off and maybe you ate things that weren't normally part of your training. It's okay to feel a measure of disappointment. It's okay to feel a little bit of guilt, but a little bit is the operative thing. If it makes you start saying either aloud or just in your own head things like you're a worthless, you know, you're shit, you messed that up, et cetera, then that's not normal. That's evidence that whatever this is for you is tied to your self-worth and self-esteem too much. Otherwise, it wouldn't do that, right? Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of folks out there who are in the gym, dieting, training. They care about it heaps. And when they have things happen, like little deviations from their routine, it just rolls off their back and they keep on going. And honestly, they end up being able to train and diet better and they're just happier. And when I meet folks who are really suffering, it's like, we're not saying that you have to stop training and dieting or that you can't build this body that you want. It's you can do those things but not feel miserable every second or third day. So let's find what that point of balance is for you, and then you can simply be a happier and healthier person who still goes to the gym. That's the point of it.
Yeah, that makes sense. How does one, let's say, a guy, early 20s, diversify their self-esteem?
Great question. Well,
can I just add, sorry, I'm saying guy in their early 20s, right? Because a lot of those people, and girls as well, they haven't built, you know, a career yet. They haven't made a lot of achievements at that point. So it's not like, oh, yeah, I invest a lot of, or I put a lot of importance in my achievements, my career, my friendships. I might not really have that. The only thing that is going for me now is maybe how I look or how I want to look.
It's a very insightful question. And I think that's part of why these kinds of disorders often have an age of onset in late teens and early 20s, because you simply haven't had as much time to expose yourself to the various domains where you might build competencies and therefore self-worth. And look, if you are, say, early 20s and you're looking to diversify your self-worth, it will involve putting yourself out there and in uncomfortable situations, trying new things, and then building competencies there. It could be new skills and new hobbies. If you've never taken a dance class before, go take one. Go do a hip-hop class or something like that and see if it takes you, right? See if maybe you have a natural talent or competency for it. If you like the people who are there and it goes from there, you might decide that you want to just be a really good brother, for example, right? You might decide that you want to be a really good and caring member of your family in general. You might decide that you want to be a better student. You might decide that you want to be a volunteer. It's not meant to be prescriptive and it can't be too prescriptive. All I can do is empathize with that it's easier said than done, especially when you're young. One thing you do see in the research for almost all psychological disorders is they typically abate in severity and likelihood as folks get older, and they call it spontaneous remission. Part of why that might be the case is because your self-worth comes from more diverse sources as you get older, so you're just more resilient to one of them being threatened.
Yeah, that makes sense. Would you say that potentially, let's say someone is really into fitness, right? It's part of their lifestyle. But thus far, they've put a lot of their self-worth or how they basically judge their competence and their success in appearance metrics. So how lean am I, how muscular I am. But you don't have, like, it's kind of hard to maintain a very low body fat and it's...
Oh, very hard.
Yeah. And naturally, you're not going to hold on to your muscle for all that long. And if you stop training, it's going to slowly regress. Would you say shifting from a fitness orientation or benchmark where appearance is the main goal to, again, a fitness benchmark, but something that maybe puts a performance goal as the benchmark would help someone with that tendency to be preoccupied about their body?
I think so. As guys who are in the gym get older, early 20s through late 20s, the sustainability of what they're doing becomes more important. Because, look, you can achieve almost anything if you're willing to, you know, sacrifice all of your time on the altar to do it. And if you put aside your mental health, your relationships, commitments to work, study, etc., but it's not sustainable. And trying to find a way to achieve something that approximates your goals or your goals incomplete, if you're fortunate, whilst it also being sustainable, in terms of your mental health, your physical health, all the other balls you have to juggle, which is just part of life. That's a human condition. That becomes the thing worth focusing on. You're going to live a long time. You're going to be training for a long time. And people like a lot of guys, when they diet and train when they're younger, I don't think it ever leaves them completely. Like it's pretty fun. I mean, I'm in the gym and I really enjoy it. I like the motions of doing it. And I don't want to ever give that up, even though I don't have a particular goal. I just like being in there. And if you're going to be like that as well, it's kind of incumbent on you to find a way to make it as enjoyable for you as possible, or at least not something that makes you miserable. You don't have to set like a super high bar. You got your whole life to figure it out. But if you're miserable every third or fourth or fifth day, let's pull that down to mildly disappointed.
I feel like just a question on a personal note, Scott. How was it like something that you've always been interested in? Like a lot of like this the psychology behind like eating disorders, body dysmorphia. Was it something like during high school you went to gymming a lot and you kind of noticed these things? Was it what was kind of the stepping stone to get into this like whole like area and everything?
It was nothing to do with me, actually. There was a person who worked at the cinema that I worked at when I was a teenager, and she had anorexia, and I had no idea what the fundamental issue was, because it was obvious what needed to be done for her to get better, which was to eat. And it struck me as so incomprehensible that she couldn't just eat so that she wouldn't have anorexia. Of course, I had no idea what the disorder was, what eating disorders were. I had no exposure to psychology in school. And now I know that, you know, that's much more complicated than it sounds. You can't just say to someone who is struggling with an eating disorder or muscle dysmorphia, well, just don't worry about it. So that was the genesis of that. And then when I was in undergrad doing a Bachelor of Psychology, I noticed a couple of male friends who would say things to me that were insecurities they were expressing, but had different forms. They reminded me very much of that girl I worked with, had anorexia, but it just manifested differently. But then when I went to find out more about it, there was nothing there. So that was the genesis of the research program.
That's so interesting. Was this like was this at the time where like the bodybuilding.com forums were starting to kick off?
Oh yeah.
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 So they were like looking at that and trying to figure out a good training split or something to that effect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or just going down the rabbit holes of what training set up to do, what diet to do, what exercises are best, what supplements are best. Like if you're at all a perfectionist or can get a bit obsessive on this stuff, the rabbit holes you can go down have no end, absolutely no end. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate because at all points, money is being made by someone selling you the better training program, supplements, dieting programs, etc. It's all kind of trading on those insecurities.
It's very easy to try to optimize all of these small things like supplements, which in reality are not even that important outside of anabolic steroids, and they have their own issues. So yeah
they're not. It's unfortunate how much we can convince ourselves that supplements and the specifics of the exact routine we're doing or not doing is the thing that's gonna make or break it. Mm-hmm. When honestly, if you want to build a body that looks a certain way, and if it's notably more muscular than the one that you have is now, the most important thing for you is adherence and staying healthy. Mm. Like if you can be in a gym for the next 5 years and you go 3 days a week and you don't injure yourself, or you just don't injure yourself very much, and you're consistent with it because it's not a program or diet that takes all of your willpower, yeah, right, and happiness away, yeah, from you, then at the end of that 5 years, you'll probably look pretty damn good. It's kind of inconceivable to think otherwise. Mm-hmm. But instead, there'll be a 16-year-old who is convinced that, you know, his first month in the gym, he needs to do a 6 days a week bodybuilding split with a creatine stack with the protein isolate. Has to be isolate, yeah, right? Because it gets absorbed faster and you have to make sure you have it within 20 minutes. What's the point? Honestly, what's the point? Because that kid will burn out, mm-hmm, right? Or won't enjoy it. It'll just be forever on this roller coaster of changes to dieting and training. When, you know, if you just did something that made you happy, you did exercises that you like, stuck with it for 5 years, you'll get a hell of a long way.
Yeah, the amount of guys I see at the gym, and like we talk about our exercise routines, and I ask, okay, so what's your split? What are you doing? And they're like, oh yeah, 6 days a week, push pull legs. On Sundays, I come in for like cardio and abs. And I'm like, okay, cool. Or 6 to 7, right? And then they ask me how often do I go to the gym, and I say four times per week. And then they ask me how long have you been in the gym, and I say 10 years. And they're kind of surprised because they're like, they think there's like 10 years, though. What, you don't go every day? Yeah, kind of like, I mean, I could, but and I do enjoy training, but I feel like I would probably kind of burn out if I did it every single day. And these are people who might be in their first year or maybe second year or first few months of training. And it's such a drastic shift to go from zero exercise or formal exercise to lifting every day. It's like building any other habit. And like, why would it stick? Why would you keep exercising and going to the gym every single day? 5 years from now, if you go from 0 to 100, like just like that.
Yeah. What you're saying makes complete sense.
So thank you so much, Scott, for coming today. And I think, there was a lot of head nodding for me, just expressing agreement and everything like that. And then the discussion was very interesting. So let's say, Scott, if our audience wants to stay connected with your work, where can they reach out?
They could send me an email if they have a specific question, or they could follow me on Twitter. I don't post as much anymore, but I am on there if they want to find me, shoot me an email. It's all good.
Thanks, Scott. Thank you so much. It's a really good discussion.
No worries. Nice chatting to you both.
Thanks so much. Thanks.